again.
You know, for such a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, I first met her in 1960.
Mm.
And we used to go for Sunday lunches.
What sort of context did you know her in?
Well...
as a political colleague or a friend?
I can't talk of that.
This thing? I can switch it off.
That's absolutely, it's just a ridiculous thing that
I could put down
a little bit, not very much, but I was... I must just tell you a little thing like this about getting politically involved. I mean, I'm born in Britain. I was born in the north of England, in Manchester. I don't know if you want to hear all this nonsense. I really didn't take middle class and didn't really take much notice of what was going on there. Anyway, I must have been about 16 or 17, and there was an election. And I decided that I must canvass for the Labour Party. So that was sort of my first slight, involvement there.
When was that?
Let me see. Oh, no, I think my first involvement must have been when I was 14. It's funny how little things stand out. It was the general election, was it 1926? Ramsay MacDonald was in power in England. And I was attending, it was my second year, I was 14 years of age. And I remember it was a general strike affecting the transport in Manchester as well. And no trams were running. And I can't remember, but we did get to the Manchester Girls High School somehow or other. And that was the first time that I really became aware at 14 of any... perhaps that was the beginning of my politicisation, I don't know. And then I decided to, can't remember which election that was now. Anyway, I decided that I was on the side of the working man, that I decided. Not on the side of the bourgeoisie, is that it? And when it came to the next election, I canvassed. It must have been 2-3 years after, because I was a kid of 14. My father took me out of school at 14. Unfortunately, he was the sort of man, although he was a very nice chap and quite progressive in other ways, he said, "What does a girl want education for?" And at that time, 1914, I was 14, and put it on to 1912, it was 1926, that's right. I'm born in 1912, you see. So he took me out at 14 after 2 years of high school. And you don't query, you know. In those days, you don't query your mother and your father. I don't know if you want to hear all this jazz, as they call it. And I went out, and he put me into a commercial school, which was also a little bit above in those days. Greenwood's Commercial School for Ladies, for young ladies. And I spent... about 12 months there, but it was a completely commercial course, shorthand typing, bookkeeping, and at 15 I was working. And I sometimes think perhaps it's a good thing when I see what kids of 15 and 16 are doing today. Anyway, then I started to learn French, and I became quite proficient in French, because I'd learned 2 years high school French, and I loved it, and I wanted to continue. So I continued night school, went to a private night school. And I became quite good in French, thought, well, I must utilize it now. So I got myself a shorthand typist job with French, as a French correspondent, and the correspondence was conducted in French, and I adjusted my Pitman's consonants, my Pitman's shorthand, to the French. So I must have been pretty efficient to take shorthand down in French. And then I was there for a few years, and I've always had the Wanderlust. And I decided, what was that? I'd been to the continent, you know, you all go on your August bank holidays. You see everything except your own country. Only when I went back after 40 years did I really do England and travel right from the south to the north. And then I decided, so I got myself a very nice job with French shorthand, and then I worked there for a few years, and then I had a friend who'd come over from South Africa. Actually, her mother was a friend of my mother's. And we became friendly, and they came back here because of the mother's health. I continued to correspond, and eventually I said to Mom, we have these cheap, what was it, Union Castles, £40 return, 3 months, 1940, when was it, 1937, £42 return, 90 days, come and see sunny South Africa. So she let me go, and after being here, then I came out to this friend, and after being here for 3 months, I said, the weather is so gorgeous. I came out in December, January, February, and I wrote to Mom, I want to stay another 3 months. It's so beautiful. Because once I go back to England, I shall never come back to South Africa. Because it's 50 years today that I'm here, you see. So she said, all right. And then the 3 months became 6 months, and she'd missed her August bank holiday. I said to her, come out with Kitty, and the three of us will go back together. And she did.
Where were you in Johannesburg?
I was in Johannesburg. You see, my friends couldn't take me out during the week, so I meanwhile had got myself a temporary job. And apparently English girls were very much in demand, because it was supposed to be a job for 2 weeks, and I stayed 12 weeks, and they didn't want to let me go. Anyway, my sister, who's in the other room, came, and mother, and we also loved the climate. We stayed at what is now the Chelsea Hotel. In those days, it was a new hotel, just opened and lovely. So we stayed there for a couple of months. We were going back in the spring or summer of 1939, and mother wrote, we had some property in Manchester. Mother wrote to the estate agents to say that we were coming back in that spring, summer. And he wrote back, don't come yet, there's talk of war. And September the 3rd, war broke out, and we never went back. Isn't that amazing? She literally just crossed, she turned the key in the house, and that was the end of that. So then when I was here, I'd been here perhaps a year,
Mother stayed here as well.
Mother stayed with us. And then we got ourselves a furnished flat once we knew that we were going to stay here for some time. Well, the war, 6 months, 1 year, and then we would go back, you see. Meanwhile, I got married, my sister got married. Mother adored the climate here, so she instructed the estate agents to sell the property. And she died, she never went back. And I went back 40 years later, after restrictions, 3 5-year restrictions of 15 years.
Yeah. So who did you marry?
I met, well, I...
What does he do? I mean,
My husband was just a rep. He was just a representative. I just met him, fell in love, and we got married, and I had 3 children. But what really got me into the movement here was that I saw in the paper a tremendous appeal for the white women, the tobacco workers in Rustenburg. It must have been 1938-39. I was only here for about a year, I can't remember exactly. And they were earning 30 shillings a week. In those days it was pounds, shillings and pence still here. And I thought, how disgusting, 30 shillings a week. And it said, please come and collect donation forms. So where were the donation forms? It gave the Tobacco Workers Union. One of the branch was in Progress Buildings. It's also now coming back to New Age and Guardian. 47 Commissioner Street, Johannesburg. That's where lots of the trade unions were, in Progress Buildings, Commissioner Street, corner of Commissioner and Von Velach Street. So I went there, and a young woman, later it was Violet Weinberg, that's how I met Violet. She gave me the form and she wished me luck. So I'm new here, I really don't know where to go. I thought, ugh, I'm going to go from door to door. And after 2-3 hours I'd filled out the donation list, and I went back and I gave Violet the money. She couldn't get over it. I said, give me another one, I'll try my luck again. And I did that, and I filled that up and I went back. And then that sort of really introduced me, because then George Findlay, a prominent advocate from Pretoria, was giving lessons on economics and socialism, and we attended two nights a week. Then I was going out with my husband, we weren't married then, and I schlepped him along. That's another word, schlep, in Yiddish, it's international. And that's how we both became involved in the political movement here. And one thing led to another. Then in 1946, which was the first, the miners' strike, I helped them in the office doing all sorts of things. And I've been involved ever since. Except 1960, we were all rounded up, and that was the Sharpeville days, and we were all arrested, and they just about, they brought everybody in, even those that hadn't been working for 20 years they brought in. And I was detained just for 3 months then, and I say that those were the 3 months of my life that justified my existence in South Africa.
What?
Because I felt that I'd done something. Once the government found it necessary to arrest me, it means that I'm anti-government, which I am. And this is what I felt. I felt that, you know, perhaps it's a funny way of expressing it, but I felt that my 3 months incarceration helped me join, shall I say, the liberation movement.
What was it like in the 46 strike? I mean, what did you actually do?
We sort of only did office work and stuff like that. Rose Schlachter, I remember that Rose and I were on typewriters. We did whatever we were told to do.
What was the feeling like? Was it a feeling of an insurrection, of a massive...
Yes, but nothing like, nothing. When I came back, I have my 3 children overseas, the 3 of them have gone now because they don't want to bring their children up in an apartheid society. And I came back, I think I was away the whole year. How long has the mine workers been organised? How long have they been organised? Just a few, isn't it? And when I came back and I heard that they were organised, and I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely in seventh heaven, because I knew that this was the beginning of the end of this fascist government. Once the mine workers were starting to be organised, because I worked for several years with Leon Levy in Laundry Workers Union. Good morning, Agnes. Mrs. Franks is still. You can do the room, but don't wake her up if she's not feeling so good. You can make my bed, thank you. Now, where was I now? Oh yes, I was with the Laundry Workers Union, and as I said, it was in Progress Buildings, and those were in the days when Phyllis Altman was Secretary of the South African Congress of Trade Unions, SACTU. It's called SACTU in those days, later banned of course. And we had some joint organisers, 3 or 4, including John Kaitsiwi and John Nkadaming, I think they've both gone. They were organising both the laundry workers and for the mine workers, which was, of course, none of them were recognised under the Industrial Conciliation Act. And John Kaitsiwi came back one day and he said, "I've just escaped with my life, because if black organisers were seen on mine property, they were shot on sight." So I know what it was to have the guts and the courage to be an organiser for the mine workers. So that was a tremendous thing. When I came back, it was incredible. I felt wonderful about that.
Now, had you gone away and then you came back?
Well, you see, when I go away, no, not in 46, now I'm talking about the recent one. I mean, they've only been organised, what, 3-4 years, yes, haven't they? Yes. I'm sorry, I'm mixing you up. No, 46, then there was a tremendous lull, and there was all this, how shall I say, intimidation. But of course, they must have been organising secretly all these years.
Mm. Did you join the party?
No, I don't know. For some reason, I don't know. My husband was a member of the party, but I never got down to signing the bottom line. But Leslie Messina, I don't know what happened to Leslie. Have you heard the name Leslie Messina?
No.
When he was on the scene, he was with Leon Levy in Laundry Workers. He said to me, perhaps I shouldn't have this on tape, he said to me, Trudy, he said, you are a much finer member of the party than the party members. Because I used to do the work, mostly about the finance. I was, you know, that I can't remember being on the finance committee of the New Age and the Guardian, but I was on the finance committee of the party. This I can't remember. Well, I think it's time you ask me some questions now.
No, I don't have to. You're telling me all the answers. Were you raising funds for the party?
Yes, And what was so dreadful? Now, when was it raided? It was banned in 1950. Am I right with my dates?
Yes, that's right.
The party was banned in 1950. And by that time, of course, they'd got all the lists. Yes, this we thought was absolutely unforgivable of those that were in charge in the office, because when they raided the offices, they just had beautiful lists to take away, and I was on that list. Obviously, they couldn't get over that. I mean, when I said that I hadn't actually signed the dotted line, you know, well, of course, I'm a fellow traveller, is that it? And more than a fellow traveller if my name is at every meeting of the finance committee of the party, you know. But they were very exciting days, those.
How did it actually raise funds?
Well, through functions, through concerts. You know, we had Cecil Williams in those days, and we had lots of very progressive theatrical people. Only through functions. Bram Fischer would have a tremendous function dance once a year, at which we all worked very hard, and we would raise thousands. We'd raise them in all sorts, and we'd direct. There was medical aid for Russia, on which I was, and you should have seen the sort of people from whom we used to get money. It was incredible. I lived in Kensington, and I must have had about 150 little women householders from whom I would take my little standard 8 round every month and collect 2 and 6 pence a month from them. When I think of that, you know how different. Everybody was giving to medical aid for Russia. When Russia was our great ally. So I really was involved. Now that I'm talking about it, I can see I was involved with the party, I was involved with New Age, I was involved with Medical Aid for Russia, and I was involved. We started little groups to try and politicize the people. That's what Fred Ivan started, little guardian groups.
I don't know about that.
Yes,
why were they called guardian groups?
Because it was appertaining to the paper, to the left newspaper, you see.
I've never heard of that. Tell me how they work.
We had little groups. Well, Rona O'Mara, I don't know what name she goes under now, Rona was also interested in The Guardian, and she thought that we should start these little groups. So she, of course, contacted all sort of the left people, and I was one of them, and I started a group in Kensington. Also, to raise money for the paper, which was always in dire circumstances. And I would invite my friends, mostly middle-class Jewish ladies, who were sympathetic. Because, as you know, the Jews are, like Hitler said, they're either in the forefront, they're either the communists or the capitalists. You can take a pick. But there were quite a lot of sympathetic middle-class women in Kensington, and I invited them, as you would to an ordinary afternoon tea party, and the group grew, started with about 4 people, and then we would have 20-25, and we would discuss the political situation. House meetings there were, which I see the Five Freedoms is tackling today. I attended a couple of them, and That grew, but of course from our glorious Russian ally, all the anti-Soviet propaganda started, and everything started to be banned, and had also just faded away.
What did you actually do in the group? I mean, once you...
Well, we would have discussions, and perhaps we would have fundraising. Oh, yes. We would have card parties and things like that to raise money. Mm. And the usual cake sales and really quite church sort of almost, but still behind it was the political motive. Mm. And we would discuss politically in as far as we could in the houses.
So how did you raise political issues among middle-class Jewish women?
Well, they would perhaps only be on the surface. Mm. Look, I started off as a middle-class Jewish girl. I was like, there's hope.
But, I mean, did they come along to these groups knowing that this was what it was about?
Yes, yes. But in that time, everything was favourable and in fashion. Mm. This was the whole thing. And they just faded away after a few years, as everything faded away.
So when would they have been operating?
That would have been in the 1940s, of course. Mm. 41, 42, when Russia entered the war. I know there was tremendous propaganda about the opening up of the Second Front. Those were the times, yes.
And how was it connected to the Guardian, these groups? Just because it had come out of the Guardian initiative?
That's right. There were the Guardian meetings, yes. Guardian, what did we call ourselves? Little groups, Guardian groups, they were. They were only concerned really with them with getting the money out of them, and at the time perhaps trying to inculcate a little political intelligence into them, you see. Which of course today, no. I'm sad to relate that I think that the whites, now this is just a broad, are irrelevant here. Took me a long time to come to that decision. I don't want to say it because I don't want to think that I'm irrelevant, you see. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty of it, how do you feel, Don?
I go along with the movement as it is today, that everybody who struggles for liberation is relevant.
Yeah, I suppose so, but when I can... But
we're not in the majority.
No,
so the majority are more important,
aren't they? Yes, yes. It's not going to stop my contribution in whichever way I can. I sort of can't do it actively because I've still got this blanket ban.
Have you?
Well, it's not a specific ban. For instance, I can't join organisations as such. But one can work for them sort of underhand or under the blanket or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Tell me more about the Guardian. Was it going when you arrived?
Yes. It was called then, I think it was called the Guardian first. Yes. Well, I became interested, as I say, and I was on the finance committee and whatever other committees were going. But I was only in a, as I say, fundraising capacity. We left the distribution and all that to Ivan or Fred. And he handled all that, and Brian when they were here, and Sonia. So they did the actual work, how shall I say, the distribution and the editing and the looking after the writing of it. I didn't have anything to do with that.
So how were the finances? Did it sort of go from week to week or month?
That's right, and there were always terrible appeals, you know, drastic appeals in the paper. And what else is there?
So they depended on you people quite heavily?
Quite heavily, because the advertising was a minimum. As is always, you know. And they would have, I think, this I didn't know, but they must have had private people who were helping the paper.
Did you ever distribute it?
Yeah, now and again, yes, yes. We would go, if we would have a meeting at night, then we would take some with us and we would distribute it on street corners and that. But they were, of course, mostly distributed there by the workers, by the black workers who were employed. Now, Winnie Cramer, it started off with about a penny. I know it was the cheapest paper on the street, and it increased, but much at a much less rate than the daily newspapers. It was only a small format, and I can't remember if it was 16 pages, 8 or 16 pages, that I can't remember. Because when they started to raid whatever journals or papers we would have in our homes, of course, we would get rid of them. The Guardian was the one that, once it was banned or that, you got rid of all your old copies. And all the other ones, my husband used to get Inkululeku. And what were the others? Freedom Fighter, which was the Springbok Legion one? I think it was the Freedom Fighter. I can't remember what it was called, something like that.
Mm. Fighting Talk.
Fighting Talk, sorry, yes, that is in my memory.
I was going to ask something about that. Who was the editor at the time? Or how did the editorial work? Was it a single person or an editorial committee?
I think that Brian was greatly, the responsibility was greatly his when he was the editor. But they must have had an editorial board. Well, I wasn't on the editorial board, so that I don't know. Was Esther able to tell you more about that aspect of it?
Not really. She was involved in distribution.
And FSU, she was involved.
Yes.
Friends of the Soviet Union.
That was her central sort of organizational involvement, it seems.
Yes, yes. I don't know much about the editorial. That would be Winnie Cramer, Winnie Dardu, who you will also see when you go to London. Mm. So you've got Winnie...
I haven't got her name on my list, but I'm hoping that Brian will be able to.
Yes, because Winnie and Brian were in the office. Mm. And we didn't sort of... I wasn't in the office to such a great extent. I would only go about my own business when I had something to ask them.
How long were you helping with the finances of the Guardian?
I can't.
The war years and
many years.
And afterwards
until it was banned and stopped
right
publishing.
Up to Spark, New Age, right?
Yes.
Did its finances?
Well, it must have been. I can't remember years, but obviously 1960 stopped everything. But it was. I don't know when it was banned. What? These years, I mean, you will find
that
you must know.
Yeah, well,
yes,
the last
yes.
Somewhere.
Oh.
It'll be on some record.
Yes. Well, actually, from the 1940s onwards, when I started the Little Guardian groups, when Rona came and opened them up for us. Rona Worrell, does that mean anything to you?
Yeah,
well, she was... she was quite prominent. Rona Worrell, married to John O'Mara.
Do you know where she is now?
No. Perhaps Esther could. Esther is still much more, she's sort of much more involved today than I am. She's kept up with her sort of political friends and that, or they're younger. You see, she's kept up with the younger ones.
It must have been very difficult for the newspaper in the 1960s because the party was banned.
Yes.
It was travelling as an independent newspaper with a lot of suspicion about it from the government side.
Of course.
And I should imagine it must have been quite hard raising funds for it in the 60s.
It was getting more and more. Well, we just continued. You know, we don't get, how should I say, it doesn't put us off to any great extent. So you work the harder, that's all. And you find new channels.
So did you continue with cake sales and parties and things in the 60s, raising?
Yes. Right through. Well, right until the newspapers ceased publication. Mm. Of course, we had to work still harder then. The harder the government clamping down on us, the greater subterfuges we have to find and contribute from our own pockets more if we could, you see.
What is it like when the paper got banned? I mean, the Guardian would get banned and another newspaper with another name would come out. How did people approach that? Were they philosophical?
Well, those that were continuing to support, yes, yes. We sort of had a little giggle about it, you know, and things like that. But those were very, very difficult days.
Because you never knew whether they were going to take you out completely or just whether a change of name.
That's right. They were sort of on to us, I think, after the second change.
Yeah.
And then they brought
five names, didn't they?
I don't know. What wasn't one called the Clarion?
Clarion, Spark, New Age,
yes.
Guardian. And one other, I think.
I can't remember.
They changed name twice in 1 year.
Probably. Yes, yes, yes. And then it became almost, it was quite a lark, really. I mean, it was, you know.
Have you any idea of the circulation figures?
No. But this you'll have to, Brian will have all these.
What else were you involved in politically in the 60s? Did you go to the Soviet Union?
No. Well, the 60s, I couldn't, I was really banned. We were arrested on April.
Hello?
Hello, Kitty, is that somebody for me?
It's for you.
Oh, excuse me one moment, please, darling. I'm sorry, I didn't offer you another cup of tea. You can have one. Now, you must see Winnie. I mean, Brian will put you in touch. Because Winnie and Brian were working together in the office for years, for the whole period, the last few years of the life of the paper.
Who did it go to? Mainly black readers or white readers? Or where was it?
Mainly black readers.
Mm.
And you see, everything to do with distribution, I don't know anything about. I just knew that we were asked from time to time to make our own little, to distribute here and there. But the main thing was done by men employed to distribute the paper.
It must have been difficult after the party dissolved, because the state was looking for members of the party. And, and in a way, the Guardian was connected and not connected. And it still was a mouthpiece of the party, or was it not?
Yes.
How did that work? It must have been extremely difficult.
It must have been tremendous. Not for us so much. I was on the peripheral, you call it that, of the actual paper itself. I was very much concerned with it and about it, and I was concerned with the money, with the raising of funds aspect of it. But when it came to the administration of the paper and the printing of the paper, that was to the staff inside. That's why I'm sorry I can't tell you anything about that aspect of it.
Brian will tell me, so that's...
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. He was the pith of it, of course.
You were listed or banned?
Yes. Oh, yes. So I was from the sergeant. So I was arrested and I was in jail for 3 months from April to July.
Of which year?
1960, Sharpeville. Mm. And they had just about rounded up everybody with their usual sort of intimidatory methods.
Mm.
And then I was released on the 7th of April to the 7th of July. And I've got all the papers. I haven't got them here because I'm roaming around now that I haven't got a house. So I left all my political papers with my daughter in Houston. But one of these days I'll take them out and I'll go with all the receipts and whatnot, but you know, they take your stuff away. And I was released in July, and I was working in my husband's business. I came out and went into his business, and I got my first 5-year banning notice. And then after 5 years, I mean, you really do reduce your political activity, as far as I was concerned, came to nil, except still helping financially as far as we could. And then they came and they clapped on another 5 years. And then I never left Johannesburg for 15 years.
What did the banning entail? It wasn't house arrest, it was just political banning.
The second ban, it was... I had to report every Monday to the nearest police station, And in front of me was Shanti Naidu, which she was on page 4 and I was on page 5. And wasn't allowed to attend any social gatherings, any meetings, could not, the usual, could not enter any institution of learning, so that when my kids got their degrees, I wasn't allowed to go. I couldn't go to bits when they were, what was the other one? And a whole list of organizations that I couldn't be a member, 48 organizations, I think everything except house arrest, which poor Helen got. She was the first woman to be restricted.
Who were you in jail with when you were in those?
With Helen, she was there as well. Mm. With Jette Barenblatt, with Rose Schlachter, with the little, what was the name? There were 21 of us.
Where?
We had the three best jails in the country, I say. We started off, the first month was in the fort, and then we heard that we were going to be separated, so we decided to have a sit-down strike. They were going to move us. And we decided, what was her name? Kate. She was the oldest there. Kate must have been 60. I wasn't so young myself. I was 47 when we were back. Lewis, I can't remember his second name. Anyway, we decided we were going to have a sit-down strike. We weren't going to go easily. And when they came in to take us away, we sat on the floor, and I've never been a lightweight. I've always been a pretty hefty person. Two women came, they said, "Please, lady, don't give us any trouble. So if you're going to take me, you've got to carry me." And a big burly man came. Oh yes, big burly man came in. They literally lifted me up and they put me into the van with the other 20. Then we were for a month in Victoria. They were much better. You see, in the fort, they never really had to deal with 21 white, intelligent women before, you see, because the only white women that they jail in this country is either a prostitute or a drunk. You know, there are prostitutes or drunks. You don't get these women, you know. So anyway, we went. In Pretoria, the facilities were much better. There were two tremendous dormitories. One was for sleeping and one was for... I mean, we were treated very well. That was the days before torture in 1960. So I learned very well from Chile and Argentina in the later years. Then we were treated very well, the whites were. And then we were there for a month and we heard, there was Shalamat Mullah, I think Shalamat is dead now. She was an attorney. Hilda was with us, Hilda Watts, Hilda Bernstein, that's right, she's coming back slowly. There was a very bright young woman called Berman, very bright, all of these were university graduates. And it was wonderful, it was like a summer, school, we had all sorts of things. Oh, we had Margaret Kalt was with us. Margaret was released before we were. Now she's what, an anthropologist from, she's retired now, Margaret. But at the time she had her medical book sent in. And Hilda gave us, that wasn't in Victoria. So then we heard that we were going to be split. Half of us were going to be sent to Nelspruit and half of us were going to be sent to Nalstrom and what was the other woman's prison? Both of them in the north and northeastern Transvaal. So then we decided to have a hunger strike. We weren't going to be split. We were going to stay together, you see. And we decided we're going to refuse the food. So we were on hunger strike for 10 days, which of course the government denied. But we managed to get the news out of the paper. Now this should be in the old annals of the paper. I think I might even have the cuttings, but they're in Houston. The 90 days of our incarceration, all the different experiences that we had. Hilda wrote a book about it, Hilda Bernstein.
What it was called?
No, it wasn't the island. No, that was the one about... No, but I remember this. They were very exciting days, and Hilda taught journalism. Margaret taught us from her medical books. I was very good at French, so we had a French lesson, we had a French class. I taught them shorthand typing because I was a very good stenographer. So I gave two subjects. I taught two subjects in jail. And it was really, it was incredible. The morale of the women was incredible. And then after 10 days, Margaret Kalk was monitoring us. And some of the girls were really weakening after the 7th, 8th day. They could hardly walk up. This was during the hunger strike. They could hardly walk up and down the stairs to go into the exercise yard. And then after 10 days, Margaret said, "Well, we've demonstrated." And of course, right throughout the 90 days, Shulamit was getting up petitions: charge us or release us. Exactly the same as today. Charge us or release us, because they had nothing with which to charge us. We were anti-government, but we weren't terrorists or whatever. We were anti-government. And they just let us out, and I was one of the last to go after 90 days. Never charged us. But they clamped on the banning notices.
What happened to your husband during this? Was he also detained?
Well, Arthur was actually a member of the party. When he heard, and he travelled from Monday to Friday. He was a rep. He used to travel in the Transvaal. He would go away on Monday and not come back till Friday. So that particular week when I was taken, I can't remember which day, well, perhaps it was the Friday morning, he heard that I'd been taken. And he, of course, he didn't sleep in the house. And after that, everybody was sleeping everywhere else. You know, the same thing as today. And they sort of never got him. But I left three small children. It was very bad. Mother came to live with him in the house with me to look after the children. And Arthur used to be here and there and everywhere. I think Michael Harmon was, wasn't Michael secretary of the party at that time? I can't remember.
He died fairly recently.
Yeah, well, yes, yes. I saw Ray, I saw his wife when I was in London in June. I go away every year for 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. I commute between the three children. I've got the one son, Victor, in London. I've got another son in Miami. And I've got a daughter in Houston. So I only came back in the 30th of November this past year. I was away for 6 months. So...
all your papers that are in Houston... wouldn't be a good idea to put them somewhere like the Ruth First Trust or something?
I thought about it because some of them are very interesting.
Oh, sure. I'm going to be there in July and I can ask Ronald Siegel to make
I can't remember exactly the full contents, but I know that it's receipts for the stuff that they took away and all sorts of... I think my banning notices are also there.
That'd be very useful to preserve that kind of stuff. It's part of the history of the country.
Yes, it actually is. It's already 28 years ago. Yes, yes.
Now, did you ever know Ruth First?
Yes, but not intimately. See, Ruth was, as I say, 12, 14 years younger than I, so we used to meet, how should I say, just in passing, so to speak. I regarded Ruth almost as next generation, and I was still with my old comrades, Rebecca Bunting. You see, I mean, I was more Rebecca, and I was younger than Rebecca, but I leaned more towards Rebecca's generation than towards Brian. So, and Ruth was Brian's generation, wasn't she? Ruth would not be in her 60s, early 60s, wouldn't you? Late 50s, perhaps. So politically, I didn't really keep on the same, what, the same rung as she was.
How did the party survive in the 50s?
It was, of course, very difficult underground. How do parties survive in all other countries?
Underground. But did it disappear for a while from 1950, or did it immediately go underground?
It went immediately underground. And then during my banning years, when work was still going on, I wasn't involved at all.
But in the 1950s, it was...
Oh, but yes, that was part of the banning in the 1950s. Well, we did all sorts of things. We did each in our own way what we could. But we never left faith and we never lost hope.
And you still have that?
Oh, yes. And this is what I find, Don, with politicos. Of course, look, I haven't been tortured, so perhaps it's a little bit arrogant of me to talk. But I find that when you arrest politicos, they don't come out intimidated, they come out more angry than ever.
Yes, it confirms their convictions and doesn't break them, usually.
Yes. This is what I found the difference between a politico and an ordinary person, shall I say.
If I was to approach writing this book, what sort of questions should I ask about the media, the Guardian, where should I come in it? Have you any ideas on that? It's a difficult question.
Yes. Look, you can only now collect your material. I think that Brian is the one who must put things in order for you. And you're going where, when did you say?
July.
In July, so you've still got March. Well, but still, for that you have to wait. So what are you starting to do now? Just get your facts, whatever you can, glean them together.
I'm doing two things at the moment. I've been for the last 6 months reading histories of the period that I can get access to.
Yes.
So that I have a context. And then I've been talking to people who were involved.
Have you spoken to... He's a mine of knowledge.
But he doesn't like talking about the 1950s. I'm not sure why.
No, that I don't know.
Always on that. I met Willie at a Cassatu meeting.
Yes.
And then I went round to his house and I sort of helped give him a bit of enthusiasm for a play that he wanted to write about the mine workers.
Oh.
And I put him in touch with the speech and drama, the prof of speech and drama here. And then I left, and when I've come back now, he's actually written the play, he's given it to the department, the department's allocating a director to him, and they're going to put the play on.
Oh my goodness,
it's just marvellous.
Marvellous, absolutely, yes.
So I'm going to go around this weekend and congratulate him.
Yes, he is a minor. He and Izzy, two old stalwarts. Mm-hmm. Willie's, he's up to... ramble on a little bit, you know.
I like that.
Particularly if you get him on the Soviet Union, I was thinking about, you know.
He lays traps to check up whether you're a Stalinist or not.
Because I hadn't seen him for donkey's years. And then I met up with him, first at Helen's, on the 25th of December he was there, and then on the 31st of December at the Heyman's house. Now, Helen always has an open day on Christmas Day, and the Haymans always have an open New Year's party on the 31st. And I met him twice, and we started to talk because I'm reading the Gorbachev book. We read it, and Willie was a little bit sceptical about the so-called reform, you see. So before we came to blows, I stopped. Very suspicious. I said, you're as suspicious as I am of P.W. Bush's reforms.
Did you know Tilly first?
Yes.
What has she got?
Have you been to see Tilly?
I'm hoping to get there, but she's quite frail at the moment.
Yes.
I want to choose my moment rather carefully.
Yes.
But no, I haven't actually seen her yet.
Well, Tilly, I lost contact with because she was overseas for many years, in England. And I was not really, I wasn't in touch with Tilly like I was with the others, like I was with Ray Harmore and Dora Alexander and Yette, the Baron Blas. I was much more close, I was much closer to them. Tilly was somehow, I don't know, a little, yes, the clouds as far as I was concerned. Very, very theoretical. Did that way.
Was there a sense in the party of a distinction between those who are up there in the theory?
Well, that's a question of one's own personal... You know, people, different people found people differently. My late husband couldn't tolerate Michael Harmore as a person. But I think you always get this sort of... There must be a clash of personality in all organisations.
That's great.
That's, I don't know if I've contributed anything. I'm sure that London will do much, much more. That, you know, fill in many, many more things.
But London is often obsessed with London, if you know what I mean. It's the people who stay here.
They'll have to throw themselves back. Yeah. I'm talking about Brian's days here. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Because he was a very bright and fine young man when he was here. What's gone on there, I don't know. Because I only see two or three people when I go there. And I'm away a lot. I make London my base and I try and go east. I've been to Russia three times.
What passport have you got?
British? What? I take advantage of it. Well, I must say, this was a few years ago. Once my children were emigrating to New Zealand, I travelled first on a South African passport, and then I realised that I couldn't travel through three quarters of the world with it. So one particular year when I got back, I said to Victor, I'm going to the Home Office forever and I'm going to get my British passport. And then it was that year that I decided that if they don't let me back again, because it's illegal to have two passports, unless you're a businessman, and then of course for expediency's sake they give it to you. They don't want to lose business in South Africa. But for an ordinary traveller, it's illegal. And I thought to myself, well, what is the worst that they can do to me? They don't let me back again. They can ban me, they can, what do we call it, exile me to Manchester. My hometown, you see. And I thought, bugger them. I've been carrying the two passports now for the last 6 or 7 years.
Useful.
I've been all over. I've been to Mexico, I've been to South America, I've been 3 times to Russia. 3 years ago I was there, May the 1st, in Red Square in Moscow. It was fantastic. Trudy Gelb, you're here in Red Square on May the 1st. Couldn't believe it. It was all right. It was all on conducted tours, and you know, you're very much restricted with the language. But still, there I was, and here were the grandmothers and parents and grandchildren all parading with the wonderful red banners. But of course, lots of things. Good things and bad things. I disagree with Willie that everything is good. Because when you go to make a purchase, there you realise how antiquated and obsolete certain things are.
Has Willie ever been to Russia?
I'm sure he has. He must have. In the early days, I'm sure he must have given, you know, the trade union delegate or something. Because he's been in the trade union room forever, hasn't he? For many, many years.
His wife, is she an anthropologist?
Sorry?
Is his wife an anthropologist?
Or a zoologist. Yeah. So she's she's retired now. And I don't think Margaret has sort of never really involved herself at all, except that she was Glyn Thomas's sister.
Who's Glyn Thomas?
Ooh, a very, very well-known leftist from Bits. Ooh, that's a name that you must make a note of, Glyn Thomas. We'll speak to Willie Kalk about Glyn Thomas. Because he's married to Glyn Thomas's sister. She was Margaret Thomas.
It's not a name that's come up in any way in the Bible.
That I'm surprised. He was very, very well known. Very well known intellectual, political leftist.
What happened to him? Where is
he? He was a member of the party.
I spoke to Yetta.
And to Franz Boshoff, he was one of the old leftist attorneys. France, one of the few Afrikaners.
I phoned Yetta to ask her if I could chat to her. And she said, oh, I don't know anything. Talk to everybody else and then phone me again and see if there's something you want.
Well, this is how I felt at first. I mean, what can I contribute when there are people who've been more deeply involved politically than I have?
Yeah.
Talking about Brian and Ivan, you see what I mean, and Ruth.
But often those kind of people don't give the context quite that. You know, they give you the political line and the position without giving you the feeling of the time, which is different. I mean, for instance, what was your response to the Congress of the People? Was it a big event? Did you go?
Oh, that was 1955, 56. Mm. Yes, I took and I schlepped the children with. That was a Cliptown.
Yes.
Yes, oh yes. And somebody, they say Clipton, I thought it was some wealthy Indian's farm. Perhaps it was the same thing. Oh yes, it was tremendous. But one of my deepest impressions was the year later, 20,000 women, the Union Building was protesting.
Did you go?
The minute. Oh yes, that was one of the political highlights of my life.
Tell me about it.
It was incredible, and I was really quite green then. What was it? We were there. I went. I must have gone with Rose. You know, it's a very hazy. All I remember was the wonderful feeling, and how my skin. What, the hairs on my arms stood up when these 20,000 black women started to sing Sikelela Afrika. Well, it was wonderful. The ululating, I think they call it. And I went, I can't remember even in whose car I went, but we were there the whole day. And we marched up to the top. We started from the bottom. I think Paul Kruger, the statue, was there at the time. And we walked through these magnificent gardens up to the top. And now, who was it? It wouldn't be Lillian Ngoya. Was it Lillian's time? You see how hazy my memory is. Lillian Ngoya, Helen Joseph. Actually, I must go back to her book. Have you read her book side by side?
Yeah.
And when I opened, the book starts with that, and when it came back to me, the whole wonderful day came back to me. And the girls the minister, of course, wouldn't make an appearance, so they put all the papers, all the protests, on outside the door there at the top of the Union Buildings, and then they quietly went back home. It was the most magnificent demonstration and display that I'd ever seen in my life. It was a hot day, and here the black women were, and the country women are buxom, even more buxom than I am, and they had their babies on their backs, and they had the sunshades over them, and it was a wonderful, orderly, disciplined affair. It was wonderful.
Did you help to transport and organise people?
No, I wasn't involved then. I was just part of the sympathetic crowd.
Do you remember if it's all?
No, I wasn't.
And you actually, what was Cliptown like? I've never talked to anybody who was there.
From all that I can remember, it was just a great big open field, and they had they had literature that they distributed. If I remember, I think there was catering, as there always is. It's very hazy. All I know, it was one of those wonderful, wonderful, uplifting times. Cliptown was one, the women at the Union Buildings was another.
And
do you know what was another wonderful demonstration, but in very, very sad times? What was the name of that young doctor that was murdered? It was a tremendous memorial meeting at St. Mary's Cathedral we had for him.
When was that?
Just a few years ago. This young doctor who used to only practice his medicine at weekends so that he could work for the movement. Oh, you see what I mean? I took a banner home. They'll be able to tell you that. A young medical doctor, Dr. Alan, no, I can't remember, this is my memory, but they would know it. The other comrade would know it. And that was the most wonderful. The nurses from the General Hospital and all the hospitals, St. Mary's Cathedral, there were thousands of us there to pay tribute to this young doctor.
Just to get back to Cape Town, how many days was it? One or two?
I think it was only the one day. Well, we were only there the one day, you know, you take your children with. It was there, as far as I know, it was just a one whole day. Could have been more, I can't say.
Were you there when the Saracens, the police surrounded the place? Because they took all the pamphlets away and took everybody's name.
I don't know. You're talking about Cape Town. This, yeah. I don't remember.
Yeah. Because I think that was on the second day.
It probably did last more than one. We only went to the one day. I mean, to show our solidarity, you know?
And were people...
I think, how many were there? About 30,000. I can't remember how many there were. I can't remember how many there were there. No, this I can't... Details I can't remember. All I know is that I was part of the crowd.
Did you collect collect suggestions? Did you help with that? Because a whole lot of suggestions as to what would make up the charter.
Yes. I think we did. Yes.
Did you just go and ask people what they thought freedom?
Yes, I think we gave out paper. You know, yes. Yes, that of course was the beginning of the Freedom Charter. Yes.
What I'd love to know is what happened to all those bits of paper with all the suggestions, thousands and thousands of suggestions.
Well, that you've got to ask somebody who was on the organising committee.
Nobody seems to know.
What about Kachalia? Yusuf Kachalia, haven't you seen him?
No.
With Amina, she's been very involved for many years.
Mm.
That's a good couple that you must see. Amina and Yusuf Kachalia.
They'd be in Durban.
No, they're here.
Are they?
They're here in Fallsburg.
Well, do you think they'd have been involved in the newspapers or have known Ruth first?
They would have been involved in the Cape Town. They would have been involved in that.
Mm. That's a good suggestion.
He's actually quite a sick man, Yusuf. I saw him also when they came to the Haymans. Izzy Heyman, you haven't seen him yet. They'll be able to tell you all about this. Izzy also is supposed to be writing a book or something.
Oh, Izzy, that's marvelous.
I don't know if I'm supposed to. Yes, I think he's. Yeah. I think he's open knowledge.
Sure.
The Haymans will be invaluable to you. Amina and Yusuf Kachalia will be able to add to your store of information. And the cult, not so much Margaret as Willie, of course.
Mm. Yeah.
And who else is there? No, these are the old guard.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Don, I don't know if I've been of any
terrific.
Use to you
Absolutely
at all.
Absolutely terrific, yeah.
You must take out the chaff from the what you've got to sort out. Or my autobiographical rubbish.
What? It's a pity I'm here so short. What really ought to happen is that somebody sits with you for much longer with the tape and takes all that down in even more detail. Not in order to get information for something else, but actually, you know, in your life is a very extraordinary one.
You think so?
Of course. You know that. I mean, how many other
people
have
had your... I reckon I've been very, very fortunate. Very fortunate.
Not many women have had that kind of trajectory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
mine. Considering where I come from, you mean, hey?
Considering that you're white and you're in South Africa.
Yes, I am. Well, thank goodness. Well, in Britain, we don't have, or we didn't have, colour bar problems then as we did now, because there were so few. I mean, my sister and I, there is permissible for for girls to go dancing on their own to these tea dance. I mean, look, I'm talking of over 50 years ago, it's another world. And my uncle had a dance, the Lido in Manchester, a dance hall. And Kitty and I used to go, and there were lots of Indian boys who'd be attending Manchester University, which has always been quite prestigious. And Kitty and I would think nothing that the boys would come up. They'd come up in a public dance hall. Can I please have this dance? So we had no colour bar as such, you see. And then when I came here and I saw what was going on here, I think I was here 2 weeks, and I said to myself, thank God I'm not born black in South Africa. And then I thought to myself, Lady Cheek is their country. So this was my attitude, you see. And I never went reactionary, as lots of Brits do, you know, plus royal que le roi, more racist than the Afrikaner, because I find that the British are very racist. Didn't realise this, you know.
But why didn't you go that way, that's odd.
Well, I don't know. Why didn't I go that way? Perhaps because I'm a mensch. Well, do you know what that means, don't you? A human being. It's a wonderful word, mensch. If you don't know how to behave in life, you're not a mensch. And I've always had sympathy, I don't know, for whatever it is.
That's good. Would that more people had.
Yes. Well, Don, I hope, as I say, my dear. So I've given you some names that will be useful. The name that you didn't know, the Kochalya, is Amina. Is a wonderful woman, wonderful.
How old is she?
Amina must be also just 60-ish. Beautiful woman still. She was exquisite as a young girl, and she's still very good looking now. Beautiful.
She worked with Helen Joseph and Lillian Goy, if I remember.
Yes. She was TIC. Yes. What is this that's going on with the Congresses? I don't understand it. I'm horrified. What I read in the paper is true. The Indian Congresses.
We've been having some discussion about that, but until I actually go down to Durban, which I'll be doing in a month, I don't really know.
I mean, if Congresses can't agree, what hope is there for world peace?
It might be getting rid of an old guard and putting in a new one. It's hard to say from this end.
I mean, the way the papers reported, it sounds dreadful.
But you
what
know,
is the word they used?
Not a cartel.
Mystical. It means mysticism. It doesn't. It help.
Something with a K.
With a C. Yes. It means
cabal.
Religious cabal. Well, that's religious mysticism or something, isn't it?
But you know better than most how newspapers report things.
Yes. I suppose. Yes. But I was quite horrified. I think it was in the Weekly Mail, or I must get it today, it's Friday today. I don't know if it was in the Mail or the big paper that this cabal was reported. Well, yes. I know that I was horrified because in my days the TIC were a very good organisation and a very solid and one doesn't know really.
Did you know Dadu?
Yusuf?
Yeah.
Yes, well, Winnie was married to him. Winnie Kramer was Winnie Dadu. Yes, I knew Yusuf. Also, not very closely. I'm afraid that my political friends were actually... just, how shall I say? They weren't as varied as other people's were. Esther's got a much, what do you call it, Catholic group of... It's a funny word, Catholic, but Catholic means vast, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
That I have, because she and Jaime were more involved than I. I don't know, younger, more vigorous, I don't know what it is. She's a very fine person.
She's scared of tape recorders, though, which is a great
pity. Perhaps I don't, well, what can I blame her, perhaps?
Well, it's not so much what they document, but that they sit there and look at you. I think she doesn't mind that.
I see. So look, we've all got our little, perhaps it's an idiosyncrasy, or perhaps it's a
caution.
caution, because I remember Rebecca thought we were terribly lax in certain aspects. She would, if there was a phone in the room, we thought that she was overcautious. She would cover it up and all that sort of thing. We actually used to ridicule her a little bit.
Rebecca
Bunting, Brian's mother. Those were in the Guardian days. Oh yes, we used to have Guardian jumble sales that were, everybody knew about them.
Where would you sell?
In our different houses. It was a whole thing. We would have a, what do you call it, a banner put up, Guardian jumble sale, this Thursday or Saturday, you know, Nanny's Day off on a Thursday. And we would have them every month, and we would make a lot of money, several hundred pounds at them. It was like we would collect jumble from all and sundry, and then we would collect sewing machines, and we would meet at different venues, and we would, it was like a factory. We used to repair other people's throwaways so that we could get much more money for them. Oh, we collected thousands, hundreds of thousands for Guardian over the years. It was a very devoted group of women.
How big was the group that did that sort of thing?
There would be 8 or 10 of us. And then we would delegate some other type of work, but our sewing group would be 8 or 10. And we would hand sew, and we would buy machines, we would get machines, we would get them on loan and all sorts. And we were really devoted. Dedicated.
You made the cakes at the cake sales?
Not me, I couldn't bake. We would collect also, and the women would bake, and the women's friends. And then those that could bake would bake the cake and buy their own cake back. You know, it was quite expensive. All these functions were quite expensive. And I remember we would have nothing. This was the party. It was a party fete. And I've always had little baby cars, and this was the little standard 8 that I had for donkey's years. And Annie Sinman, who also was a very good political friend of mine, was so very friendly. She and I would go to the Indian market, and we would load up this poor little car with fruit and vegetables until its springs were nearly on the floor. And then the party offices, I think we had the fete in Dornfontein, and we would go and we would offload the fruit from our poor little car. But I think what I didn't put into it, ready for.
And then you would sell it at a bit of a profit.
Well, it didn't cost us anything because we bumped it off the Indian fruit that the vendors, the wholesale. You know, at the bottom end, even today, where did we go? Yes, down at the bottom of Diagonal Street there. That's where all the fruit, the Indian fruit vendors
were. Did they give it to you?
Oh, yes.
For the party?
Oh, yes. Those days, yes. And money, where we couldn't get merchandise, we would ask for donations. Oh, we were the world's, Annie and I were the world's biggest schnorrers. You know what schnorrers are?
I can imagine.
And selling tickets, so that was another form. When there would be a dance or a function, you have to go out and sell tickets. And we would go, and in those days, Market Street was where all the wholesalers were, a lot of Jewish wholesalers there. You know, soft goods like Bloch and Co. and Randall, Brothers and Hudson, before your day. And we would go and we would sell hundreds of tickets. I was a very good saleswoman.
What are the dancers like? I mean, where were they?
We had one big dance at the Guardian. We printed tickets, and that would be at Bram Fisher's house in Oaklands. And then we would have them at different venues, at Trades Hall or something.
And what sort of music would you have?
We used to hire bands, or they would come and play for nothing. A lot of voluntary work.
Yeah. Do you remember the names of the bands?
One or two of them probably became quite famous after that. I can't remember that. Who would remember that? Black bands. And then in those days, of course, we had to watch with the liquor because you weren't allowed to serve them liquor. And here they are in the same house was the function, you know. I remember Brahm and Molly always used to be very, very careful with that. What wonderful people they were. He was a prince among men. Absolutely, he was a wonderful, wonderful man. Quite tragic what happened to that family. Molly also. Oh yes, Molly Fisher was in jail with us. And Molly was also an angel. And she would find, she would justify even the most wicked person. She would find some good in them. And once I became irritated, I said, for goodness sake, Molly, stop being such a good person. You can't see bad in anybody. We were very friendly. Absolutely angelic, this woman.
But she's still alive.
No, that was a tragedy. They were going to, was it Cape Town, to celebrate Ilse's 21st birthday. Brahm wasn't with her, obviously, no. And they were driving at night, and instead of taking the bridge, there was like a big, what would you call it, like a big ramp to the left. And Brahm must have been driving. He must have been very tired, and instead of taking the straight road, he went to the left. And at the bottom of this, there was a big pool of water. It was absolutely a freak accident. And it was the winter, that was about the only part where there was water there. And Molly was drowned in that. It was unbelievably awful, terrible, terrible. Oh, that was dreadful. So Ilse, of course, is still... Have you seen Ilse?
She's on my list.
Oh. And who else is there now?
Ruth, her sister.
Ruth, I've lost contact with her. But where is Ruth? She used to be in Rhodesia. Is she here now?
She's here. She's a therapist.
Oh, but she's not involved at all, is she? Or
I don't think so.
No, never. I don't think she ever has been. It was Ilse who was the... Look, we remember those little girls when we had jumble cells also at the first. They were just little girls who helped, like my three did at the time. I'd have my three rolled in on the Saturday afternoons, helping sell.
Was there any theatre that you remember connected to the party, you know, putting on productions?
Yes, there was a Left Theatre.
Because the Young Communist League used to put on...
We used to have it, yes, because I attended a few of them. One of the actors was Izzy Rosenberg. You must speak to Bertha when you go. Well, of course, I think, mind you, I don't know if everybody is in touch with everybody else, because apparently the London crowd are very spread now, and one doesn't see the other, and one works and one doesn't work. But Bertha Rosenberg is another name. Bertha and Izzy Rosenberg. Izzy died a few years ago. They were very much involved with the Left movement. Hilda lives out of London now, doesn't she?
I don't know. I have to find that out.
And I don't know. Anyway, you see through Brian, and if not Brian, then you contact Ray Harmer at the ANC.
Interesting.
I didn't. She goes in to work there. I was told that I mustn't go. I didn't go.
Probably a bit, yeah.
As it wasn't worth it. I would just go and say hello for a social visit. It didn't merit it. So I listened to what I thought wiser people. I was dying to go. I did attend an anti-apartheid lunch. I saw Benny and Mary Turok. I didn't see Benny. Mary Turok was there. A few of the old comrades were there. Paul Joseph was there. But I haven't been in touch with him for years. If I were to go and live there, then I would
connect up.
Really get myself involved, yes. But I think just going there for a few weeks or that, I don't know if it's politic or not. Well, I was told not to.
You might get hassled when you come back here.
Well, they said it wasn't worth it. So I didn't. So I just see my few comrades. I see Winnie when I go there, Winnie Dardu. I see Ray Harmer. I see Phyllis Altman. I see Dora Alexander, now Dora, she's married to a lovely old trade unionist. What's that, what's her married name? Not Hart, it'll come back to me. But I just see a half a dozen people when I go there. Sort of, you know, people with whom I was very close.
Do you live in Houston when you're there? Your daughter?
My daughter lives in Houston and Victor lives in London in West Virginia. And when I go to America, of course, it's a wonderful continent, but the culture is terrible. And their political ignorance is appalling. I can't believe it. I mean, there must be quite a few intelligent people of 240 million, but they're certainly not in Texas, and they're not. Huh? I really, my dear. Jane Fonda's married an intelligent bloke, hasn't she? He's apparently in, what's his name? I've forgotten now, but Tom somebody or other. There must be, because there is opposition. You mention the word communist and everybody trembles in their shoes. It's unbelievable.
Funny country. Were you ever involved in the Left Book Club?
Oh yes, we were members of the Left Book Club.
How did that work?
Had to get rid of half of them when they were raiding the houses.
How did wonderful. It work? I mean, was it really a book club?
Oh yes, that was also in Commissioner Street.
Yeah. But I mean, it was
that's also where I was introduced with Findlay, George Findlay. Wonderful, wonderful Marxist, wonderful.
Is that the chap who lectured?
Yes. Okay. On what was it? Simple Marx, sort of elementary steps, you know, as when I schlepped my husband. And we joined the Left Book Club. I remember that's where I read The Socialist Six of the World. I think that's where I bought it through them, or I read it through them. And Leo Huberman's Man's Worldly Goods. Isn't it funny how old names come back to you? So yes, I was a member of the Left Book Club.
So in a sense that was your route into the involvement?
Yes, that's right, yes.
It seems to have been for a lot of people. It's quite an important recruiting ground.
Sort of a little watershed thing there, yes. But no, my recruitment was the Tobacco Workers Union, I reckon. Tobacco workers. The strike of they were all white workers in those days. And that's my introduction to Viola Weinberg and Solly Sachs. Viola was working, I think, in the library there at the time.
What did people do at the book club? I mean, was it a social function, a meeting house, or
I can't remember. Perhaps George Findlay's lectures were as an offshoot of that. I really can't remember. All I know that all the activity went on there in Commissioner of Von Bella Street.
Pity it doesn't now. I'm sure I've taken a lot of your time, and thank you.
No, I don't mind. I just hope that I've been able to contribute. That's all.
In fact, at some stage, if you don't mind, I'd like to come back and say, you know, I found out this can lead.
Oh, then perhaps that will lead me on. Give me a lead to something else.
Yeah, that would be really nice.
Yes, with pleasure. If you just phone me. And
that's marvellous. If you're not in England or America. or Russia.
Oh, it was exciting. So with my British passport, I went right through Europe, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia.
Yeah, my wife's family comes from Czechoslovakia.
Yes, Prague's a beautiful city, beautiful. Yes, and Russia, very exciting, and so vast. Did you say you've been there?
No, my wife's family comes from Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, but you haven't been to the USSR, no. And we flew from Moscow to Central Asia, to Uzbekistan, which, you remember, there's Tashkent, Bukhara, and what's the other big one? There's three big cities in there. Samarkand. little girl, I mean, as a schoolgirl, you know, you read about the spice route from where to Samarkand. And that was another time when I pinched myself and said, Judy Gelbu on the Caravanserai route, the spices from the east to the west. Wasn't that it in our history books? You remember as a historian. It was and such a difference. Here you are in the land, in Muslim country, and you've just come from, how should I say, hardly a Christian country now from the north, because most of them are agnostics or atheists, but they haven't been able to eradicate the Muslim culture as quickly as they have the Christianity, because a lot of religious schools are still there, and magnificent mosques. Oh, what an experience, what an experience.
Were you on a guided tour?
Yes, yes. But we had a first-class Russian guide, Boris, who was with us for the whole 3 weeks. And it was fantastic. It was like really going through a fairyland. It was wonderful.
What was his reaction? Did you tell him about your past and your collections?
I said that I exaggerated a bit. I said that I was a member of the party, hoping that he would... Well, I mean, my feelings are there, but I was never... he was very amiable towards me, much more so than the rest of the coach. And we would have little private conversations, and I would be asking millions of questions about trade unionism. And I always saw that I had the front seat next to him, you see, otherwise. Asked millions of questions, and some I was very impressed with, and others I disagreed with. I disagree with the lack of... And, of course, it brings me to mind, during our war years, and when we were all very pro-Stalin, and horrible stories were coming out about the trials of the Jewish doctors... And things that did set you thinking a little bit, but people like Michael Harman and Willie, of course, wouldn't hear anything. Stalin could do no wrong, and I used to query it, you know. And then, in many decades later, when it was an anti-Stalin period in Russia, and I think I met Willie and I met Michael, and I said, you see, we can criticize. It's not what... Because they wouldn't hear a word. Stalin was 105% correct, and I was querying it. I said, it's got nothing to do... One thing has nothing to do with the other. I came back from the Soviet Union with lots of criticism about the million pairs of shoes. Well, I must tell you this. I was the laughing stock, because when we mentioned... Willie went crazy. I came back and said, you know, Willie... I said to him, this was on the last occasion when I nearly had a fight with him. I said, we went into a shoe factory.
I'm off, I'll see you later.
Yeah, all right, my dear, have a nice afternoon and look after yourself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Don, this is my sister Kitty. Kitty, Don, I don't know if I introduced you
I'm croaking
officially.
Like a good thing.
Oh, dear.
I've given up smoking and I feel worse now than I did before.
I said it's
worth sticking it out there.
Worse than before. I'm coughing worse than before.
I said it's all the rubbish that's coming out of your body.
Me to stop. Goodbye.
Yes, Boris, this was our guide. So we went into this place and that place, and one place was a boot factory. And I went up, I examined the boots. When I came out, I said, Boris, I just don't understand. Russia can send men to the moon. She is way ahead of rocketry, way ahead of America in certain space projects. Why can't you produce a decent pair of shoes? Am I right? Am I right? I said, it doesn't make sense. I said, and the prices are the equivalent of 30 American dollars. Because I think that the exchange was $1.50 to a ruble. And you know what? He agreed with me. And now everything that I said is coming out, and it's true. You read Gorbachev's book. Mm-hmm. So when I came back and there was any criticism, they used to say, Trudy and the shoes or the boots, you see. And then I saw in one of the little news things, 1 million pairs of shoes had been sent back to the factory because they weren't fit to wear. It's all part of the stagnation, of the lack of incentive. But at the end of my criticism, I would say, because I spoke to many little groups, they wanted to hear, you know, about May Day and about Russia and my impressions of Russia. I said, well, for all my criticisms, there's only one system in the world that works, and that's socialism. I said, and every time I come back from Europe, from overseas, I'm a firmer socialist than I ever. So I sort of reassured them that my criticism is absolutely objective. It is, it's absolutely absurd. The contradictions that go on that could be improved. And you see, I'm right, because whatever I said is in the book.
You and Gorbachev agree.
Incredible. This is exact. But I said, you can't fault the education. Well, you can fault it, but it's, up till now, it's the finest education in the world. And I complimented and boosted the things that impressed me. And when the Americans are just looking to complain, because they're all Americans, I did the tour from America, when they're just looking for points and to pounce like a vulture on everything they don't like, then I would come back at them and I would say, what do you call for? I said, here there's no unemployment. Here every man has a roof over his head. Here every man is guaranteed the right to work. What freedoms have you got? Freedom to starve, freedom to be unemployed, freedom to have a bullet into you. I said, there's a no more violent society in the world than the States. Oh, I used to give them what for. I don't think they liked me very much. But I would come back here and criticize certain aspects of the Soviet regime that I didn't like. And I don't like this lack of freedom of speech. And I don't like this lack of not letting the Jews go. Let them go. Not my husband said when he was alive, and it's quite a few years ago, because it's been going on for 15, 20 years, you see. He used to say, you see, only if you're a Jew can you say this. Let the bloody Jews go. What is he keeping them for? The 10 or the 20 or the 50,000? And I agreed with Arthur. Because here we talk about repression from weakness. Why are all these terribly repressive acts? Because the government acts out of weakness. But the Soviet Union can't act out of weakness. It can send them out from strength because they are so strong. So it has no need to repress. This is how I analyze it. I might be wrong. You basically repress from what? Not from strength.
From fear, yeah.
From fear and therefore from weakness. And that was the difference between the repression, as I saw it, of South Africa and the repression of the USSR, that they had no need to do it.
Perhaps you can tell me something in that case. In 1956, Khrushchev came into power after Stalin died. And his report to the 20th Party Congress was very anti-Stalinist. It was a speech against the cult of the individual.
Yes, yes.
What effect did that have on the party here, or people? Was it known that he'd criticised?
Oh, yes, yes. From here we were, from, as I say, Willy Kalk's attitude of Stalin can do no wrong, and all of a sudden he's absolutely in the mud. From one extreme to the other extreme. Now, I say that Stalin served a wonderful purpose up to a point. And then he was no longer a positive role that he played. Then he played the role of a despot. But it was he who, how shall I say, coagulated Russia.